And welcome to the 14th weekly Teneo Insights call on the impact of COVID-19. Things are beginning to move. The Health Secretary was on the radio this morning proclaiming the battle was being won against coronavirus. Shops opened on Monday, and today it was announced that theme parks, museums, and leisure centres are working out how they can reopen safely. It's also being heavily hinted there are going to be air bridge programmes that will allow us to go abroad this summer. The world's first coronavirus treatment proven to save lives is being given to patients, though to be clear, it doesn't stop you catching the virus. And yesterday it emerged that the average number of deaths in London in the first week in June was below the average for this time of year. It's harder to make the case that the economy is buoyant. It was clear from Monday's employment figures that the furlough scheme is masking hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions, that are effectively already redundant. Many expect unemployment to hit at least 10% and stay there for some time. Stock markets are yo-yoing on optimistic and pessimistic news. There are real fears whole sectors of our economy, from hospitality to tourism to culture, may never fully recover. As ever, so much to discuss and another brilliant panel to do so. Sir Peter Bazalgette is the chairman of ITV and former chair of the creative and creative director of Endemol. He'll offer his perspective on the crisis as a FTSE 100 chairman and discuss the impact of COVID on the arts. Baroness Nicky Morgan is a former education secretary and secretary of state for DCMS, chair of the Treasury Select Committee. She'll share her perspective on the crisis as a former secretary of state for education and give her insights into her new role as a People's Commission on Life After COVID-19. Simon Levine is global CEO of DLA Piper. He'll talk about how the legal sector is responding to and changing in the light of COVID-19. And Orson Porter is a Teneo senior managing director and head of our Washington DC office. He'll update on the situation in the US regarding COVID-19 and the Black Lives Matter movement. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right-hand side of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, as always, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for broadcast or publication in any way. So that done, let's get to it. Peter, let's start with you. As chair of a FTSE 100 business reliant on advertising, this must have been an incredibly testing time for you.
Yeah, it's been very tough. In the history of commercial television in Britain, which started in 1955, the worst year was 2009, when advertising fell across the year by about 9%. We'll be lucky if we get away with 20% this year. So it's been very, very tough. But it's been interesting reflecting on what it's forced upon us and how it's made us think. And I'm not going to go into sort of the dirty details of dividends and liquidity and all the other challenges we've had in business terms, but it does occur to me that we've probably done 3 years of modernization in 3 months, particularly with regard to AI and digital tech. One of the things that's going to flow from it is we're almost certainly going to be reducing our use of office space in various places where we have our companies. And in some cases, by up to 50% over the next 2 or 3 years. We've had to think very hard about the curation of the mental health of our staff, our colleagues, working at home, and in what circumstances they're working at home, and are they looking after themselves properly. There's going to be a reappraisal of executive remuneration, which was a pretty controversial subject in the first place, but there's been many changes to that during this emergency, and I think that will have a long-lasting effect. And I think also it's led companies to have a rapid reassessment of their public purpose. I think we're all familiar with the old Friedmanite idea that your only responsibility is to deliver value to your shareholders. There's been a big debate around this over the last few years, and I think most people think companies have a public purpose beyond that. But in a national crisis, it really gets you to define what your responsibilities to the community are. And I think the Black Lives Matter campaign of the last 2 weeks has only strengthened that. So we have to ask, who are our stakeholders and how do we deliver for them? So those are some of the questions other people might like to pick up on, Craig. But if I may now, I'm just swiftly going to move on to, you mentioned the arts. I used to chair the Arts Council, and I've done a lot of work in the last 3 or 4 years over government policy, really, for encouraging the growth of the creative industries, which have been up to now a very important part of the economy. Craig, not in your wasn't in your summary, but there was a report out this morning you'll have seen from the Creative Industries Federation, which was very depressing. Creative industries as defined cover, as you know, are advertising, marketing, TV, film, radio, video games, and so on, but as well as the arts, the performing arts. But it looks very, very grim at the moment. And so I'm particularly interested in what things we're going to need to do for the creative industries. In the short term, we've got to get theatres, concert halls, film studios functioning. This might need for the performing arts furloughing extended for the arts sector. It might need the tax credit advantage that they have that we negotiated with the last government raise. Most of all, we have to deal with fear. It's for the same reason parents not sending kids to school. So effective has the government campaign been in lockdown and getting people to stay at home. Everybody's now scared witless, and we can't get parents to send kids to school, and we can't get people to go to theatres, even if we conquer the 2 meter social distancing, which at the moment makes all that impossible. I just wanted to say a quick word, since I chair a broadcaster, on how important media has been during the crisis, how I think we've understood the real importance of public service broadcasting that's delivered by BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, how trust in reliable news is critical in an emergency to national resilience. And I just want to say that if we want public service broadcasting to survive in the future, when all of its distribution in the internet world will be on internet platforms owned by foreign companies, whether it's Amazon and Apple, whether it's Sky, Comcast or Virgin, or whether it's Samsung and LG connected televisions, we're going to need the signals of the public service broadcasters guaranteed carriage on those platforms, prominence and fair value, which means we need a new Communications Act to update the 2003 Communications Act. And finally, I'd just like to say that having been involved in the last government's very good work on a sector deal for the creative industries, one of the things that depresses me about British politics is even when the same party is in power, but it's a different prime minister and a different cabinet, everything is not invented here. So good ideas are usually have to be to survive, have to be rebadged. We have a great sector deal, some very good investments in innovation in the creative industries. But at the moment, I'm worried that this new government is not taking it seriously because they want to put their own name over everything in that rather, if I may say, Tom Cattish sort of way. Anyway, that's my sixpence worth. Craig, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter. That was fascinating. Nikki, you were Secretary of State for Culture. We'll deal with that in a minute. I want really, though, to focus on you as somebody who was Secretary of State for Education and also Chair of the Treasury Select Committee. With the education and schools thing hat on, a lot of people think things like the care home scandal has been the national scandal. Is it not also a national scandal that we failed to get children back to school? And it looks like it's going to be September at the very earliest. What are your thoughts on that and how the government's handling it?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to follow Peter. And I think you're right in a way to link education with the economy in the way that Peter's done about culture and the media with the economy. I think the longer term implications. So you mentioned I'm involved with both the Demos Commission on the virus crisis, but also the House of Lords have just set up a committee to look at the long term implications. And I think what most concerns me about the education handling has been the long term implications of young people not being in school. Peter's absolutely right about the government was very successful in its original messaging about you must stay at home. But you know what's now happened is that people are fearful of returning, and as Luke Johnson made clear in and I think we know, you know, only three people under the age of 19 have tragically lost their life to the virus. Now, you know, any loss of life is obviously something to be enormously regretted, but the fact is that our young people, it would appear, are either not so susceptible to the virus or not transmitters in the way that other generations are. And that should have given more confidence, really, in the way that schools were you know, brought back. I think one of the great difficulty of this, and Craig, you've been there at the centre of government, you'll know that when there's a crisis unfolding, in a way, you need two teams of people. You need the people who are going to think about the immediate crisis and the handling and the messaging, but you also need a team of people. And frankly, this is what secretaries of state are there for, to say, what are we going to do to in the long term? to support the particular sector? What are the challenges? Now, I think actually the education system moved pretty swiftly in terms of resolving what's going to happen about exams taken this summer. But you know, there's a lot more to it than that. I was doing a debate last night, and obviously as former digital secretary, I was doing a debate last night about online learning, which may work for older students, and I think it's here to stay in many capacities. But in terms of the inequality of access to digital, literally the access to laptops, the inequality of broadband provision, we spend a lot of time in the education department working out partnerships with private sector organisations to get iPads into schools and to get hardware into schools, to get schools more connected. And in a way that actually businesses have now suddenly discovered, actually, you don't necessarily want all the IT and the hardware in the schools when you're facing something like this virus. You've got to have it in people's homes. And then, of course, the implications for working parents trying desperately to ensure that their children are being educated or looked after, but also trying to meet their employers' expectations. And then there's a broader concern there about the gender impacts of that. And I was talking, fascinated to hear what Simon's going to say. I was talking to the senior partner of another law firm who said it was her female members of staff who were all contacting her to say, we're really worried about the fact we can't do our jobs because our children are needing our attention. I hesitate to say that it wasn't the men who were making those calls, but there we are. Now, the other thing I wanted just to talk about was about the economic stimulus package that I think is coming down the tracks. I completely take Peter's point. That report this morning is incredibly depressing. And, you know, our cultural sector, our creative industries, contributes more to the GVA of the UK than aerospace, automotive, oil and gas and life sciences combined. It is a key part of our UK global soft power. And it's also good for our well-being. And, you know, the joy of watching National Theatre productions online or the Royal Opera House or whatever it might be, the Curve Theatre in Leicester during lockdown has been incredibly important, I think, in keeping spirits up. And we've got to remember that. And I think for as long as government rules on social distancing or dealing with the virus mean that certain sectors, particularly obviously culture, venues can't open, hospitality is harder, I think the government support is going to have to continue. And I think I completely take Peter's point about different governments. I think we're very lucky, actually, in terms of we have a prime minister who is not afraid of being interventionist, and clearly a chancellor too. It's not naturally, I think, where the chancellor comes from. But, you know, the furlough scheme has been a remarkable thing. And actually, the speed at which that is wound down will, I think, determine how serious the economic crisis is, because the UK economy depends on consumer spending. And, you know, as long as people feel that their job prospects are OK, they will continue to spend, particularly when there are places, you know, reopened to go to. And I was talking to someone last night, tourism sector, and I said, frankly, I think people will go with masks. They just want to get out of the four walls they've been trapped in for the last 12 weeks. And so we've got to give people places for people to go. We've got to give them opportunities to spend their money. And we've got to make sure that we maintain that confidence. You know, £7.4 billion have been repaid in people's savings. So I suspect there are members of your staff who actually have saved on commuting costs, for example, and who aren't buying expensive coffees anymore. And therefore, actually, there are some people for whom this crisis has meant that actually the household expenditure has gone down. But we know there are other people for whom that's a very different story. And so I also wonder more broadly, you know, and again, part of the Demos Commission, the House of Lords, people say they want society to change. They want inequalities to be addressed. You know, it's up to the politicians, I think, to lead the national conversation on that. And to think, well, actually, and Peter mentioned the Black Lives Matter campaign, which I think has come at a really important moment when actually there's got to be a national conversation about narrowing those inequalities. I think there's got to be a conversation about which bits of Whitehall worked and which bits didn't. There's a fascinating Policy Exchange report about the military planners brought in to help, not just in the NHS, but elsewhere, and the military attitude towards planning. But you've got to have very clear objectives. And then finally, I think we just shouldn't forget the things that worked. You know, the dogs that didn't bark, universal credit. Actually, 1.5 million people had their claims processed and have had some money coming in who weren't claiming universal credit before. I can say as a constituency member of parliament, I would not have been confident 2 or 3 years ago that that would have been the case. And actually in our job centres, we've got fantastic skills now about getting people who are far removed from the workplace back to the workplace. And we're going to have to redeploy all of that. the furlough scheme with HMRC, anybody who's claimed, the fact again that that new system did not fall over when hundreds of thousands of businesses logged on the first day to make claims is also quite extraordinary. The oxygen supply that worked, and then obviously we've seen yesterday's health announcement, which again I think is really important for UK global soft power and the confidence of our life sciences industry. So there are some good things, but there are many challenges ahead. And I think the extraordinary thing watching it is that this is, for all of us, not the year that was planned, but certainly not the year that was planned for Boris Johnson and the cabinet. You know, trying to re-pivot or pivot to find those new skills in a very short space of time when the spotlight is on you has been and will continue for them to be the most monumental challenge.
Nikki, thank you. That was great. And just to remind people, as I say, on the top right-hand side of the screen is the chat function. Please put your questions in there and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. Simon Levine, I'm going to come to you next. You're the CEO of a major global law firm. A lot of people probably thinking that the opportunities for lawyers in all of this are huge. What's your take on that?
Well, there were some that won't make us very popular, but I'll come to that in a minute. I'm going to draw some of this together because in my lifetime, I was actually a sports media lawyer, so I've still had a bit to do with what the sports industry is doing at the moment. Peter doesn't know this. I actually used to be in a firm in partnership with his other half. But anyway, that's, you can say hello to her for me, to Hillary, because we work together. But also because I sit on the board of the Office for Students, so I have a view on education too, which is the university regulator. And one of my other partners sits on the Social Mobility Commission, and we've been working with Justin Greening on a bunch of stuff. So if I can draw all of those together, I will. But let me just talk in two capacities first. One is someone running a large global business, and also someone that is running a business that tries to help and work with many of our clients who are operating, of course, in the UK and around the world. And a few different things for people to think about, I may raise, because I agree with a lot of what Nikki and Peter have said. The first is, I think we and a lot of our clients have found that this is very different to the GFC in 2008. There's a lot more liquidity in the market. There is a banking system that is working. Whether it's working for you is another matter, but it works. So as COVID hit and we got all these triage requests, they were very much around contractual issues, financial issues, structural issues, commercial issues. And what hit most of our clients and hit us as a business was the suddenness and severity of that impact. And the fact that, and this is the only political sideswipe I'll take, I promise, is the fact that when you operate across the world, there was no alignment between government, scientific or medical advice. So we're in over 40 countries. We have had to operate 40 sets of rules, which is a crazy situation to be in when you're trying to get people back to and work, and many businesses have had that issue. And the other issue we found, just as a general thing, I'll talk a bit in detail about a couple of things, is there's been too much short-termism. And we are trying as a business and encourage our clients also as an advisor to think longer term. And I was interested to hear about military planning. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So few big themes. It's pretty easy for most people, unless you worked in manufacturing plants, it's pretty easy to move to lockdown. It's going to be a lot harder for people to move back to office-based working or even agile working. That is really difficult for a bunch of reasons. Technology, you rely on people having good broadband at home. In this country, lots of people don't have good broadband. Health and well-being, stress, all those issues. There's been a big debate in business about whether or not you take state aid. It has not been an automatic thing. There's a whole morality issue here. I hesitate to get into business politics and morality, but there's a whole issue about to what extent you take state aid and when it's appropriate, such as the tax break that's coming up, where the deferral in tax. We had a couple of years ago, we were part of the NotPetya cyber attack, not something I'd wish on anyone, but actually for those people who've been under any form of crisis management, it was helpful. Our IT systems and our disaster recovery planning were better than some. And we produced, a number of businesses like us have produced playbooks. So you talk about longer term strategic planning for your people and financial scenarios so you can manage your costs according to what a financial scenario you're going on. In terms of what we found with our clients per se and what the legal issues are for the legal industry, certainly people want a lot of tailored advice. They've got this issue between what's going on globally and what matters locally. So lots of people have wanted multi-jurisdictional ready reckoners. We advise, we put up like lots of big law firms, Corona Virus Resources Centers. Ours has had over 500,000 hits. We had a seminar the other day that had 1,000 people on it. I mean, something mental, because people are thirsty for some sort of knowledge, online knowledge. I talked about scenario planning. We've been working with two types of scenario planners, a military strategist and a virologist. Neither of those are things that law firms typically work with in any way, shape, or form, to try and help our clients understand what a longer term scenario might be for businesses. Because we found military scenario planning organizations seem very good at that sort of thing. I didn't know that. That's something I learned. So I talked about that. In terms of the sort of advice the clients have needed, everyone thought restructuring was going to be the big thing. Actually, right now, it's all about emergency funding. You are going to get a ton of restructuring and insolvency issues out there, but they are only going to come once that state aid in all these countries disappears, and then people have to face up to reality. Right now, it's all been about rights issues, funding. You know, can you get the money out of the banks? Are the banks really passing on the money through and all that sort of stuff? Lots of technology and supply chain issues. You've read about force majeure. I happen to be, you know, we happen to work with, I won't say, a very large football organization that may even be kicking off tonight. You know, you've heard about all those sort of things about force majeure, you know, is this frustration in contracts, all that sort of stuff. Actually, to date, there's a positive in this. I think commercially people are trying to play nicely and do the right thing. With almost certainly, and forgive me if I'm going to upset anyone by this, probably some of our own clients, but landlords, people aren't very happy with landlords right now. I think they tend to feel that those who insist on not giving people rental holidays or taking breaks on rents are the ones who are playing least fair of all. Lots of HR and employment issues. Peter rightfully talked about health and well-being of people, moving to agile working, what that does to your culture. And I will finish and say one other thing on the thing that every lawyer likes to talk about, or people accused of, which is litigation and litigation culture. There is going to be a litigation culture. If you look in the US and Canada alone, there's been over 600 COVID-19 class action cases commenced already in such a short frame of time. Class action litigation is coming all our way. We will probably end up testing some of this in the Supreme Court in the UK, whether that's around the contractual things, insurance issues, HR issues. If you want to get people back to work, can you force them to get back to the office? If people say, until there's a vaccine, I don't ever want to go back to the office, can you force them to come into an office, which people will need them to do? So that's not going to be that simple. And last thing I will say is, looking ahead, the future, when we talk about this wonderful new dawn, is not going to be that straightforward either, because unless you have really good IT, you have a great setup at home for health and well-being and safety point of view, you have great data control, you have great broadband. And Nikki is 100% spot on. The biggest single issue our people have is childcare, and who's going to look after the children. You're just not going to have this nirvana of a flexible, new, agile way of working where we all trot around happily in a brave new world. It's going to take a lot of thought. So that's all I've got to add on that, and I'll happily take questions.
Simon, that's great. Lots to chew on there. I'm going to go across to Orson Porter, who's in the States. Good effort, Orson, getting up so early. Thank you. We're now less than 5 months away from a presidential election, and the COVID and Black Lives Matter crises are still looming large in America. Give us an update on where you think we are in the States, and particularly in terms of the presidential election.
Absolutely. I think the election is a lot like the weather forecast today, stormy here in DC. We're 130 days out, 138 days before the election. And I think what you're seeing is there's basically four or five key issues that are on voters' minds: the COVID response, the current discussion on race relations, the healthcare industry, and of course, the economy. As a former political advisor to President Clinton, he taught me, and I learned firsthand, you know, in presidential elections, there are only four or five or six states that matter. The rest are what we used to call flyover states. You wave as you go by, you run political ads, but The states that are on the map today are states like Wisconsin, Florida, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Michigan, and potentially Minnesota and Ohio. So in all of those states currently, Vice President Biden is up by a large percentage point. But keep in mind, in 2016, Hillary Clinton polls reflected the same as Vice President Biden's, and she lost. So, polls are very hard to measure whether or not a candidate is going to win in the U.S. Lately, they have been wrong. And we have, Trump in the office, who rightly proves the polls wrong. And I think that's the big discussion in D.C. I also think that the other big issue in D.C. is what's happening in Congress. So there's a real possibility that the Senate could, if Biden has a strong turnout, could easily become a Democratic House. So, D.C. would be turned on its head if there was a Democrat in the White House. If you had a Democratic-controlled Congress and Senate, then a lot of the things that I'll discuss on the Black Lives Matter campaign will be fully addressed in a different way should that happen. So, the key issues outside of D.C. are that's facing the election is the state budgets, and I think that'll play a big role in how people consider their selection of candidates. A lot of our states, because of the COVID epidemic, are facing huge budget deficits. California, for an example, has a $60 billion budget deficit that needs to be filled. So they're, waiting for Congress to act. Congress has spent about $4 trillion thus far on our stimulus packages. We probably won't vote on another one until after the 4th of July recess here in the U.S., so that's another month or so. So the candidates are addressing, you see Democrats being more in favor of supporting states, whereas Trump may be more in favor of talking about things such as liability issues for businesses and not necessarily giving big checks to Democratic governors in key states. The other key thing to watch in the presidential election is, and I think it matters this time around, is Biden's vice president's choice. He has disclosed that by the 1st of August, he's going to announce who his running mate will be, which I think equates to what we're going to get into on the Black Lives Matters too, in that right now there's four candidates that are on the radar, one of which is Senator Harris, who ran, who I think is the leading candidate, former attorney general, who has a really good story on law enforcement issues. Another surprise candidate that has kind of shot up the selection process is Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, who many thought probably would not be a selection, but has, a good record related to the Black Lives Movement, has really good connections with key members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And in some of those battleground states that I mentioned, could be an added resource on voter turnout. And the two other candidates are probably more selections of where they're from. A congresswoman from Florida, Val Demings, is under consideration. She, too, is a former black sheriff of Orlando, Florida, who speaks directly to the law enforcement community, and then Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, a key battleground state. So, to sum it up on the presidential side, it's early. Don't believe the polls. The national polls don't matter. The key polls that do matter are the state polls, and right now they're trending in Biden's way. Trump is probably has a 5-to-1 margin on fundraising, which in previous elections, I would say, would matter, but Biden won the Democratic nomination with no money. So I think that is an attestment to that it doesn't really matter if you have the movement behind you. And then the key issues to watch out for, which we'll go back to, I think what the panelists have said is, if kids aren't in school in September, I think President Trump is in trouble. If kids are in school and there's a possibility of a cure or there's real movement on the medical piece, then I wouldn't be surprised if Trump found a way to address some of those key issues in those battleground states and was reelected. So, I think September is a big month here, is when Americans pay attention to what's going on the presidential side, and then they'll start to focus in. If the unemployment rate is still high and kids are out of school, then there is a high probability that you could see a wave of Democrats in Washington, D.C., and that not only the White House, the U.S. Senate, and then retaining the Congress. Quickly on the Black Lives Matter movement, it's been interesting to watch here in D.C. I think, elected officials, kind of like the Me Too movement, haven't really found a easy way to join the conversation because it's a movement. We had Mitt Romney, who was a presidential candidate, join the march last week, and it was great that he did it, but it was a still odd sight to see in that he was trying to find the right tone to speak to why he was there. The local response has really taken over the national response, and that's probably the same with a lot of our corporate partners. What they do in their backyard matters more than what they say nationally, and you better make certain if you say something, your backyard is ready to be exposed. And that a lot of corporations who have come out in support of the Black Lives Movement have quickly been hit with, well, let me see what movement do you have in your own internal organization, what board diversity do you have, your senior management team. So this movement is one, if you plug into, you better be ready to tussle. I have seen a couple successes of late. One in particular, you saw President Trump yesterday move on a law enforcement executive order to study or to put a database of officers who have maybe not had great records, and then talk about the issue of police brutality. I will say, if it wasn't for this movement of 2 months, there's no way that President Trump would have held a press conference in the Rose Garden and conceded the fact that a study needs to have happened. So, it will continue to be a top issue in the presidential race. It will continue to be driven locally instead of nationally. But let me say this, that should President Biden or Vice President Biden becomes president, or should the let's say Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, not become vice president, become attorney general, should the Senate be controlled by the Democrats, then all of these things we're talking about will become legislative matters that people will have to pay attention to, and most importantly, corporations may have to respond to.
Awesome. That was great. Thank you. Fascinating. Lots to talk about there. Let's get it to the Q&A section. As I say, do put your questions in the chat section, which is the top right of the screen. But Peter and Nikki, I'm going to start with you. Both of you touched on purpose. I saw today that in the FT, when I was just coming in, that a growing number of FTSE CEOs are back on full pay, and it was mentioned that it was Foxton, Severn Trent, Persimmon. Is that a problem that we see that kind of thing? Are businesses going to be criticized for that kind of behavior at the moment and not showing enough concern about that? Or is it actually just absolutely perfectly right? Peter, let's start with you.
Well, look, there are two separate issues there. One issue is that if you're a company that is relying on public support, whether that means you're furloughing your staff, or whether it means you're taking government loans like the CCFF or one of the smaller company loan schemes, or if you have indeed abolished your dividend, so your shareholders are no longer receiving a dividend, you have to show restraint in executive remuneration. If you've done none of those things, you wouldn't say, in a technical sense, you need to show that same restraint. But then there is the broader issue, Craig, which is that there is a general desire by shareholders and by government to reduce executive remuneration. There has been downward pressure on executive remuneration for some time. And so that is a broader issue that has to be addressed. The particular angle for investors representing shareholders at the moment is pensions, where they don't think executives should have pensions that are a higher percentage of their salary than the average of the company. And so they're really gunning for people who, executives who've got pensions of 25, in some cases 30%, when the typical average in a company will be somewhere between 6 and 10%. So that's just to say that there are two aspects to it.
Nikki.
I mean, I think Peter is absolutely right. I mean, it is particularly linked, obviously, to companies that have either taken state support or not. Having said that, I would have said that for all of those companies, it's not really a headline that you need to see. And I think, you know, as ever with these things, is it just because the companies understandably said, well, we'll do this for 3 months and then we'll see what happens, or have decisions been taken? I think the other thing, though, is about whether companies are going to make significant amounts of redundancies. Again, so, you know, I think if they are, then I think people will take a dim view of executive remuneration going up, back up to the levels that it was. And I do think, look, I think the banks have found, I mean, you know, there's no doubt the banks, in terms of their response to this crisis, and their willingness to get stuck in on the loan scheme and everything else, was absolutely shaped by the public reaction to the bailout of the banks after 2008. And any bank you talk to is very mindful of, well, how do we seem now? What's the perception of us now? Are we seen to be doing our bit? And so I think those companies that have unfortunate headlines about executive remuneration now are going to find that's going to carry on. That'll be rumbling around for some time to come. And I think it's absolutely fascinating. I mentioned in my remarks about interventionism. I think it's fascinating that alongside the conditions of some of the loan schemes has been no dividends payable and about executive remuneration. And I think that really reflects public concern. I think we'll probably end up seeing more of that. So I think this is a trend that is here to stay.
Thanks. Simon and Orson, Simon, you touched on the reality of like a lack of global cooperation and that you have 40 different rules around the world.
Yeah.
And Orson, there's a sense that in the past, the states would always have led in terms of global cooperation. Simon, just talk a bit more about that and the lack of that and what are the consequences of that. And then Orson, I'll come to you on the state's role in that.
Yeah, I have to do that. I mean, I was I had a meeting occasionally. What you get as CEOs, you're getting invited to all sorts of meetings. So I had a meeting with the UK government and some European ambassadors, and I was explaining this. And all they wanted to talk to me was about how each other were being intransigent in relation to Brexit. And I said, I don't really care. I'm really bothered about the well-being of the people in my business around Europe, and you don't seem to be interested. So it's very frustrating, because unlike the GFC, what happened in the GFC was actually governments did broaden, regulators and the banks in particular, the state banks got together, but you agree with everything you did. But from a state point of view, there was an attempt to try and be aligned as to how you came up with an answer to this problem. What has happened here is, for various reasons, partly because the pandemic, the virus has hit at different times. So we have offices around the world. We were dealing with an issue with our offices in China and then in Milan long before we were dealing with our issues in some other parts of the world. But the reality of the situation is that going to lockdown, you noticed it less because everyone went to lockdown in a reasonably near period of time. It was frustrating. Getting back to return to office, which is what all governments are urging organizations like us and our clients to do, is a nightmare because they're just urging us to go back and make sure we can get the economy going. But what am I doing in each of my offices? You know, have I got a 2 meter distance, a 1 meter distance, a 1.5 distance? You know, what's going on in the outside world? Can I have client meetings, not have client meetings? Everybody has a different set of rules, and it's very hard to operate on a global basis, which most businesses, many global businesses, need to do, as opposed to 40 separate businesses, which costs you a lot of money and causes a lot of confusion. And I do think some attempt at governmental alignment, medical and scientific alignment, is really, really important. And if I can just, there's one last thing, because it connects to the previous question you asked that Nikki and Peter were talking about. Most governments in most businesses in being urged to get back up and running, like ours and our clients, want to try and do the right thing. Having said that, they also have a big moral, there's a big moral question in relation to business, because as the state aid gets withdrawn, you are going to see more pressure on businesses about whether they make redundancies or not. You don't have to always make redundancies. It's a choice between whether you decide to do that or what you do to your profits or what you're paying people or what dividends you're going to pay. So you're going to see that play out over the next 6, 9, 12 months and beyond. And that's going to be a really key aspect of this, I think.
And also outside the United States, there's been a lot of criticism of the American administration for not taking the lead on this in the way that it might have done, say, in the 2008 crisis or even Ebola or something like that. Is that something that Americans feel and worry about, or is it just we don't really care?
Well, I mean, the governors in the U.S. have decided to take on the key leadership role on, you know, how to assess essential employees, how to address the issue locally. You know, unfortunately in the U.S., the governors is really broken down to red state, blue states. So you saw a lot of Republican states reopen their businesses, and now you're seeing major spikes. The biggest spikes in the U.S. right now are in Florida and Arizona, and that's because I would say that, you know, the governors of those locations decided that we're going to keep moving forward. And where you saw a lot of blue state governors like New York, California, New Jersey, where they were hardest hit, they now have the pandemic not necessarily under control, but are moving things forward. So to answer your question, I think what you would typically see out of the White House has been transferred to the governor's offices. And I think it might have been a miss by Trump to give that speakerphone up to the governors, because now with this crisis, I wouldn't have said that Governor Cuomo would be my leading presidential candidate in the near future, but there's a lot of talk about Governor Cuomo being one of the top presidential candidates, as well as Gavin Newsom of California. So, you know, a lot of things that would typically happen in the White House are happening at the state and local level. And I think, you know, from a global perspective, a lot of these governors are now reaching out to global leaders as they consider themselves almost nation states to kind of address their issues in their own backyards.
Okay. Peter, we were talking about that Creative Industries report earlier. You know, you're the chair of a broadcaster that has to make many, many hours of television programs for every day. You're also deeply concerned about, you know, the arts, that kind of thing. Is it possible for you really to be optimistic about this, given the difficulties for each of those industries and creative bodies to actually do stuff? How optimistic are you, or how pessimistic are you?
Well, look, I am very pessimistic about this year. I think it's extremely tough right across the creative industries, from the publicly supported arts sector, which is closed, and they're mostly charities and they're running out of reserves, and some of those quite well-known theatre companies and dance companies are going to go bust. They're going to close down. And commercially, the creative industries is made up of a lot of freelancers and small SMEs in a sort of mutual support sector, and that's closed down as well. So I think this year, you know, the creative industries in 2018 was worth 112 billion to the British economy, and that was 7% up on the year before. The number for 2020 is going to be a shocker. So that's one thing. I am very alarmed, worried, concerned about what we do about it. But there's another point to make. And I think I've seen one question in the chat about shouldn't the government be putting money into infrastructure? I mean, one of the things that the creative industries represents is innovation and the future economy, the knowledge economy. The creative economy is going to create jobs over the next 10 years when AI is going to destroy it in other sectors. So it has a real strategic significance. And I'd be optimistic in one sense that it has great potential, even though it's had a terrible knock this year. And if we get those policies right, and they're not just a question of whinging to government and trying to get a government to intervene and spend money, it's what the sector is going to do in partnership with the government in terms of investment. I myself proposed to the government for its sector deal last year, investments in creative clusters around the country and in future tech like virtual reality and so on, and that's happened. And that's connected the, amongst other things, it's helped 300 SMEs, and it's connected the excellence of research in our universities to those SMEs in a very productive relationship. So there's lots to do, but we start from a very tough place.
Yeah, and as you and Nikki were saying, the scale of the industry is huge in terms of what it provides for the economy. Nikki, I just want to move on to something that you were saying. You made a very good fist as a loyal Conservative of defending the government and how well it was doing, and made some very good points, I thought, in terms of what has been a success. It would be fair to say that there's been quite a few things that have been problems too, and a lot of confusion in terms of the messaging. For example, on last week we had a situation where the quarantine was being announced on the day that it was also announced that schools were not going to be reopened, but then loosening of the restrictions. There's a question in the chat section here talking about Marcus Rashford. How did the government get that so badly wrong? It does seem to be very unsteady, a bit confused, contradictory messages coming out. Is that not fair?
Look, I undoubtedly the government has struggled, the machine has struggled. I think there's a few things that have knocked it off course. I mean, I think Boris Johnson's own illness and the fact that he was absent, completely understandably, for a critical 3 to 4 week period. I mean, he looks fine, but you know, the reports are from people who've had the virus that actually it really takes it out of you. And again, as anyone running a big organization knows, you know, you've got to be fit. You know, it's, I mean, I've had more sleep in the last 3 months than I've had probably in the last 10 years. you know, and well, those who know you might say I look like it or not. So we'll see. I mean, the Dominic Cummings thing really, really obviously hit the government for six. And I think really affected the relations, the confidence that government backbenchers had in the number 10 handling. And the Prime Minister is the sort of person he likes to have. He's got a very close group of people around him. And I'm not sure that, you know, how much they often will take advice from outside about how things look. I also think we've got to be really careful, though, about not judging things now or things that happened, you know, 10 weeks ago, 12 weeks ago with what we know now. It's very easy with the benefit of hindsight to say, well, this is obvious and that was obvious. And there will be time for inquiries and everything else. But I mean, clearly there's got to be the political operation number 10, I think, got to be really revved up, the link with, you know, what's going on in Parliament. And as I say, that need for strategic long-term thinking is really, really important. So the free school meals, you know, it's fine, it's a good announcement, but how does it fit in with what we're expecting schools or charities or others to do with young people over the summer? You know, serving a free school meal is one thing, but actually part of the reason, you know, it's not just education. Schools play a real part in safeguarding of young people from abuse in the home. And that's part of the thing about the free school meals actually in summer. Again, it's an opportunity to watch vulnerable young people and make sure our social services, for example, is up and running and able to intervene. And you know, all of that's got to work and come together as just as a strategic package. And that, I think, is what's frustrating about watching from the outside.
Thank you, Simon. There's you mentioned about the level of litigation that was going to happen, and I think probably a number of the people watching had a little bit of a shudder down their spine. Other people bringing up the possibility of businesses worried about opening up because they're worried about corporate manslaughter. Is there a danger that the legal side of it and the lawyer's side of it is actually going to make this worse and cause more problems? Or do you actually feel more optimistic in that it can be a solution?
Well, I suppose not. I'm bound to say I think I'm optimistic. I think it'll be a solution. But I genuinely do think that. I mean, I think that the culture, legal culture you have in any country, and we operate across many countries, so I have the privilege of looking at what goes on across lots of different countries, not just the UK, US, Asia, Europe, Africa, Middle East, wherever, is actually a reflection of the culture that you have in your own country, in truth, without trying to offend anybody. It does reflect. So I think for the most part, one of the things I said that we have seen in a lot of places is that where there have been disputes, contractual supply chains, whatever, actually a lot of clients have, our clients or businesses have come together and tried to find a pragmatic solution rather than saying we want to just throw money at lawyers and just end up going to courts and everything. And the fact that although courts are operating, the fact that they're operating in a virtual technological way, which is good, I mean, they've done a good job of it, but I think almost encourages people not to literally run to court because they know it's not that straightforward. So let's just try and find a pragmatic solution. I think in those countries, and I mentioned the US and Canada without any disrespect at all, but in those countries where there has been a long tradition of class action litigation, and we're certainly having it in other parts of the world too now, but particularly in those countries, if you have large damages settlements, people tend to resort to that because they think that's the first action before you then get to talk about a solution. So I do think some of it's reflective of the culture. I do think litigation always has a role to play, but it also means that other people are looking for someone to blame here. And if you have, you're insured, or you've paid your money, or you expect your government to look after you, or whatever it is, you what people are thrashing around trying to find ways of looking after themselves. So I think there'll be a rough patch and there will be some litigation, but I don't think it will end up being some sort of feeding frenzy. The last thing I will say, Craig, is though the point you make about, you know, people being worried about what they do when they ask their employees to get back to work is a very real issue, because the employee legislation in most sophisticated countries now is, you know, there's a lot of protection for employees, quite rightly, as there should be. But it goes beyond just asking someone to use public transport to go to work. If you're going to ask someone to work at home in this famous agile working nirvana we're going towards, then you better make sure you do a health and safety assessment of their home and make sure they've got the right take the right furniture in there and the right equipment, because you're going to be responsible for all that too. And I don't think people are focusing on that when they're talking about what the world will become. So we've all got a bit of adjustment to go, I think.
Sounds like DLA Piper is going to do quite well out of it.
Well, I can only hope, obviously.
So Orson, I know I'm treading on very tricky ground here. I read a piece the other day about Joe Biden, 77 years old, basically suggesting he's not in the best of possible health. And you were talking about the vice presidential candidates, and essentially what the piece was saying was whoever's vice president has got a quite likely chance of being president or certainly a candidate in a second election. Is it almost possible that there's going to be more focus on those people than Biden himself?
No. Biden himself and the VP candidate, I think, is secondary to voters going to the polls. I think, with respect, Biden is a great candidate, and I know him, and I think he'll be a great president. But had it been Elizabeth Warren, had it been the mayor from South Bend, I think the enthusiasm for Democrats wanting to get out and vote, regardless of who the candidate is, would have been high. And we had a special election in Wisconsin recently where people stood in line for 6 to 8 hours to vote. We had a special election in Georgia last week where people stood in line 6 to 8 hours to vote in the midst of a pandemic, and didn't leave the voting sites when it became stormy. So I think there's so much enthusiasm by Democrats to get out and vote that it won't matter much on who's on the ticket. I think it will definitely matter that you select the right person to answer your question that could potentially serve the second term. That's why I think Elizabeth Warren has shot up on the consideration charts, because I think she would be able, as well as Senator Harris and Senator Tammy Baldwin. But I think this election is a little different. I think people are really excited to get out and vote. And the candidate matters, but I think who they're voting against matters more for Democrats.
Okay. Well, we're coming to end of the hour. We've got one question that I just wanted you all to do 30 seconds on. This morning we got the UK inflation figures, which are down, it's down to 0.5%, and the prediction is it's actually going to go negative. So we're going to be in a deflationary cycle. There's also the suggestion of, you know, negative interest rates. How worried should we be about the reality of that and the economy going forward? So, Nikki, let's start with you, because you're probably best qualified with your Treasury Select Committee background.
I'm not a fan of negative interest rates, and I think that, fortunately, I think a number of senior people at the Bank of England aren't either. So I think they will tread with extreme caution. I think the inflation was expected to go down, given everything that's happened, particularly relating to oil prices, obviously. I think we'll have to see. No decision should be made without seeing a couple of months worth. But I mean, look, we're in for obviously a potentially very significant economic shock. I think the Chancellor of the Bank of England are right to say they'll do whatever it takes to stand behind it. But the point made as well about it's not just us. Obviously, the economy is more much more global. We're all very interdependent. And what we haven't really touched on is the wider geopolitical ramifications of all of this, particularly in relation to our relationship with China, for example. So we are in, I think, for unprecedented times. And we will have to see. I think so far the Treasury Bank have shown that they can be very nimble, as have other central banks. And there is potentially a sort of talk now about whether rather than inflation target, we should have a GDP target. I wouldn't be surprised if potentially we saw that being added to the Treasury and Bank of England arsenal.
Peter, does deflation, negative interest rates, does that chill you as a businessman?
Well, yes, I don't think I have a technical understanding of it, which Nikki clearly does have, so I will bow to her on that one. What I will observe is that obviously we've got a severe recession. We may have a depression. I feel very sorry for my kids aged 29, 31, their age group. I think it's going to be very tough for them indeed. But I'll make one observation which does relate to inflation, and that is this. We are going to have massive government borrowing, massive government debt, and we are not going to have another austerity regime like the coalition, because Boris hasn't got it in him to do it. As a consequence, raising taxes does not, so which will happen to some extent, does not pay off that debt. So I would suggest to you, Craig, that the only real way to pay off that debt is inflation, deliberately having inflation at 4-5%. Unfortunately, if you ask for inflation at 4-5%, you might get it at 15%, because it's not an easy thing to do. But I think we need going to need higher inflation to pay down government debt over the next decade.
Okay. And then Simon, just very quickly from you, because we're running out of time.
Oh, look, I can be quick. I agree with what Nikki said. I'd prefer us not to go into negative territory. I happen to think the central banks generally, I criticise governments, but I do think the central banks generally have done a pretty good job. And although this might callous, I really don't mean it, because I also have kids who are going to be affected by this. But I do think there are times, if you pardon the pun, when you've just got to take your medicine. And in this case, we have a recession coming. We're just going to have to work our way through it and try and encourage businesses to grow to the point where we can give people jobs again.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the hour. I wanted to just very quickly say that next week we have the former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and the Sunday Times business editor Oliver Shaw. So I hope you'll join us then. But in the meantime, I'd like you to all be giving a virtual round of applause to Orson Porter, Peter Bazalgette, Nikki Morgan, and Simon too. So that was fantastic, guys. We really appreciate it. And imagine the round of applause coming now.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye,
thanks
guys.
For the questions.
Bye.
Cheers,
thank
Craig.
You. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.